I'd like to call the meeting to order of the House Oil and Gas Committee. It's Thursday, the 22nd of March, 2007, 3:08 p.m. Welcome to all the folks in the audience for, to the meeting and to the members of the committee, as well as the guests of our colleagues that have joined us. We have with us Representatives Mike Dugan, Scott Kawasaki, Kurt Olson, my vice chair, and Ralph Samuels. My name is Vic Coring, the chair of the committee, and we've also been joined by guests of the legislature. David Guttenberg and Beth Gertula is around here somewhere as well, who would like to be a part of this meeting. So welcome to all of you, and look forward to the remaining members of the committee here to join us shortly. Today, as I had mentioned in previous meetings, is to hear from folks at FERC. That's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in Washington, D.C., that administers regulations that govern interstate pipelines, and certainly will play a major role in the AGIA bill and the subsequent contract and hopefully pipeline construction. I've been told that we have the FERC folks online, and the individual that is currently online is Robert Cupina. And forgive me, sir, if I mispronounced your name. Mr. Cupina, are you there?
Cupina, that's exactly right. Yes, sir.
And before you start, sir, I just wanted to thank you for joining us. I know you're in D.C. and you're 4 hours ahead of us here in Alaska, so it is 10 after 7. So thank you very much for working late hours to address this committee.
We hope we can help.
Yeah, you bet. And just wanted to let the audience and the committee members know that Mr. Cupina is with the Federal Energy Regulatory, he's the Deputy Director of the Office of Energy Projects. And, sir, I understand, too, that Mr. Katz is to join you, or perhaps?
That's my understanding.
Okay.
We're not in the same location.
Okay.
Yeah, this is John Katz. I apologize. I was stuck with the beautiful guitar music for a while, but I have gotten the script.
Well, thank you very much for pulling yourself away from your personal time there at this late hour. I appreciate that, Mr. Katz. And might note that Mr. Katz is the Deputy Associate General Counsel for Energy Projects with the Office of the General Counsel. So two very obviously knowledgeable and experienced gentlemen here and representing FERC in a great capacity. So we'd like, gentlemen, if you'd be so kind to offer some comments, if you would, some opening remarks. I understand that you were going to brief us on the language as it relates to FERC that is in the legislation before us. And then what we'll do is just open it up for questions from the committee members here. So, gentlemen, take it away.
Okay, this is John Katz. We only really have a brief opening statement. First of all, Rob and I are both employees of the commission, and so when we're testifying, the opinions and testimony we give are our own and don't represent those of the commission or of any individual commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'll say briefly with respect to the bill is we've read it very carefully, and we don't see anything in the bill that is inconsistent with the statutes that FERC enforces or with the regulations that FERC has issued. And beyond that, we really don't have anything to say by way of an opening statement, but both of us would be glad to answer any questions you have. I can handle legal issues, and Rob is very expert in how the commission actually processes and reviews applications for energy projects.
Okay. Thank you. Rob, do you care to offer any opening remarks before we get into questions?
No, that was our joint introduction.
This might be a very short meeting, depending on my colleagues here. Any questions from the committee that you care to launch into at this stage? Representative Mike Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, we've heard testimony from the administration in explaining the bill that you read that said that they contemplate a set of circumstances in which a licensee could be named, they could proceed to an open season, gas is not committed at the open season, yet they could continue on and get a license from FERC. And I'd like to know what you can tell me about the likelihood that that could actually happen.
Well, let me say, this is Robert Cupina. I think conceivably that could happen. We have, and I base that on several things. We have a certificate policy statement that is pretty much what the commission follows, was issued in 1999, and it does not require any particular level of contract commitment. Prior to that, there was a minimum level. Secondly, the Alaska Gas Pipeline Act of 2004 includes a finding of need within it. But having said that, I think that given the, you know, the scope of this project and the kind of commitment of resources that we're talking about, and I don't mean the natural resources, I mean the human resources that would be brought to bear on this, we'd all be much better off if we had shipper interest following the open season. So it's conceivable if we could, you could get a certificate without it. It would be better all around if there were contracts or precedent agreements.
Representative Dugan?
Thank you for that answer. Does that mean that by extension that a successful applicant for a FERC license for this project wouldn't have to have, wouldn't have to be able to demonstrate some other source of financing to continue the project?
There's a finance exhibit. It is included in the application, and so sure, there'd have to be some plausible financing as part of the proposal.
Okay.
And again, most let's face it, as a practical matter, most projects are represented by contracts. That's just the way the business runs.
Thank you. Just to make sure that I understood that answer, then the applicant, in order to be successful, would have to show some financing, but not necessarily a successfully completed open season.
I think that you can say that it's accurate. It's certainly not typical. It's not, that's not the way these big projects are usually done.
Yeah, also, as a practical matter, I think were there to be an open, it may depend how you define the term successful, were there an open season that resulted in no commitments whatsoever, I think one could anticipate, if there were an application, one could anticipate other entities coming before the FERC and challenging the bona fides of the application based on the failure to get commitments. Now, what the commission would do with that question, I don't know, but it's certainly a lack of getting gas contracts would probably open the door to some issues that it would be preferable not have to be raised.
Before I go to Representative Samuels, I wanted to recognize Representative Nancy Dahlstrom, a member of the committee, who's joined us. Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you.
As well as the leadership of the House Minority, Beth Curtula. Thank you very much for joining us,
Thank
Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Samuels.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I've got questions on the financing also. In legislation, you can go 5 years after, you get through an open season, you get the certificate, you've still got 5 years to get your financing together. How long is a certificate good for? And what would be the procedures to go on in those 5 years? I would assume you have no gas, or you'd have the financing.
Oh, again, a typical situation. The certificate requires the completion of construction within maybe a year or two. But that's excuse me, that's more common, and of course there are contracts as well as all the ducks are in a row for construction. I suppose this situation, because it has certain unique aspects, the term of the contract, or rather the certificate, would be longer if that was part of the proposal and it was justified.
Okay,
some of the LNG projects, for instance, are 3 or 5 years to completion.
Is this Mr. Katz speaking, or is this Rob?
It's Rob.
It's Robert Capito.
Okay, I just want to get the name straight because we have folks that are putting together our minutes for us. Just want to make sure we're able to clearly identify who's speaking. So thanks, Rob. Representative Samuels?
Thank you. Regarding, probably for Mr. Capina, but sales and transfers of the certificate, and I go through these scenarios in my mind, is the state puts up the $500 million, your partner puts up $500 million, you get the certificate. If I am, and pick a company, if I am Mid-America or TransCanada and I have this certificate in my hands now, can I sell it? Can it be transferred? Can the state own it at the end of the day?
And John Katz will give you the legal reason for this, but there's something in the Natural Gas Act about non-transferability of certificates, which I think would mean that whoever has the certificate would have to, in effect, vacate it, and whoever wants it would come into the commission and ask for it as a successor of some type.
So
right. This is John Katz. Yeah, what Rob says is correct. I mean, the commission, I think, historically, and the Congress in passing the Gas Act didn't want there to be sort of a secondary market in certificates. Now, it is possible that an entity holding the certificate can be bought or sold, as long as the certificate still is held by the same entity. As to the state issue, we really haven't had for the commission before in which a state was a pipeline certificate holder. My suspicion, and this is just purely my speculation, is that the commission would try to do what it could to make an Alaska pipeline project work and would at least look very, very carefully on what it could do to assist that effort, you know, in terms of not raising undue legal barriers and whether state ownership would pose a problem.
Okay.
The commission would have to address that issue, but I don't think the commission would be looking to set up barriers before any Alaska project.
Okay, I appreciate that on the state ownership. But now back to the transfer and sale. So if Mid-America gets the license, there's $1 billion total spent, the state has $500 million, Mid-America has $500 million, the certificate belongs to Mid-America. If they decide to vacate and sell it essentially to TransCanada, that commercial arrangement between those entities, is that something that the FERC is going to look at? I mean, if Mid-America's got $500 million into it and they sell it for $750, they just made themselves $250 million by selling a certificate to another company. Could that happen without the FERC regulating a commercial deal between entities?
No, as Rob said, the Natural Gas Act does not contemplate certificates being sold, so I think the answer to your question would be no.
Would be no?
Correct. I don't think that would be something that would likely be permitted for someone to just sell a certificate to make money.
And if then, I mean, if I could follow up one more time, then I'm trying to think of the various scenarios. If I get to a certificate owned by Company A, after the certificate is owned and they now partner with several people, but they do not buy, you don't have a BP Conoco consortium buying TransCanada, but they want to join the consortium that owns the certificate. Is that without a commercial deal between the entities after the certificate has been issued? Where does that go lead us to?
Rob, I'm not certain on that one. I mean, typically when deals like that are made, it is more typically in the course of certificate proceedings. For example, when Kern River and Mojave were fighting vigorously over who was going to build the first interstate pipeline into California. They sort of fought up to the 11th and a half hour in the certificate proceeding, but then reached a settlement before the commission acted on the certificate. Afterwards, I think, is much more difficult.
And Representative Samuels, maybe this would help just by example. What we run into from time to time are what we call acquisitions of facilities versus acquisitions of securities. And the idea is one company acquiring another company's facilities, and let's just say in this case acquiring a certificate, would be FERC jurisdictional. One company acquiring another company's stock is not FERC jurisdictional. So just in those terms, in terms of securities versus physical assets, jurisdictional assets, or in this case, a certificate even prior to the physical assets.
Thank you.
So if somebody's buying TransCanada stock or Mid-America stock or XYZ stock, that's not under FERC.
Yeah, and this is John Katz again. Again, my informal sense about this is if the transactions you're talking about were something that there was a sense that all the parties involved were comfortable with and felt that this would move forward an Alaska project, I think the commission might view it one way as opposed to this is a money-making venture by, you know, one of the certificate holders just trying to make money by selling its certificate, or there was opposition to the transfer of the certificate or something like that. I think that would be viewed differently by the commission. That's my guess.
All right, thank you. I'll let somebody else go for a while.
Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to ask a follow-up to that question, then the FERC has a procedure to deal with the situation in which after a license is granted for this particular pipeline and another company comes in and buys, I don't know, 30% of the whatever entity is set up to build the pipeline. Is there a FERC review process in that case, and is there an established procedure for that?
How would they be buying 30%?
Are they just buying the portion of the company, like buying 30% of their shares?
Yeah, there isn't a pipeline to buy 30% of, so I think what you'd have to do is buy 30% of whatever entity actually held the certificate from FERC.
I think if it's to make it a joint venture, then they have to come to FERC. If this was a certificate to one entity and now it's going to be a certificate to a joint partnership of some type, they have to come to FERC. If it's, as we've been saying, an acquisition of the first company through some kind of security or merger or whatever, that's not a FERC matter.
Right.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you. I guess the question I'm trying to get to is this:
okay.
if there's a FERC procedure for dealing with a situation in which somebody was buying into the company as opposed to buying stock, essentially creating some sort of joint venture, and there's a FERC procedure for that, then I would imagine that there would be situations in which FERC would rule that isn't allowed. Is that correct?
Yeah, we had, maybe something close that we had several years ago were these limited partnerships where, you know, questions arose as to whether certificate holders got involved in limited partnerships and thereafter the limited partners held the certificate. And, you know, did that require commission action? And the answer was yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So I think the idea would be, yeah, the new entities, you know, or the combined entities would come in and say we want to amend or revise this authorization to reflect this new arrangement that we've done.
And that procedure wouldn't involve the original licensee having to vacate the license and have a new one issued then?
I think we would really have to see the fact, and we're trying to be as helpful as we can, but it's sort of hard to deal with hypotheticals. We'd need to see exactly what was being proposed in a given circumstance.
I appreciate that. Unfortunately, all we have here is hypotheticals.
I know.
There's another phrase under the Natural Gas Act that you might keep in mind, and that is that the entity, the certificate holder, must be able and willing to do whatever it is, you know, that the commission authorizes. So, you know, it's just going back to, you know, who can do that, or what do they have to show to be able, especially. That's what drives some of this.
Mm-hmm. Wanted to let the non-members of the committee know here that are present, Representative Cartul and Guttenberg, that you're welcome to ask any questions too.
Thank you.
Feel free to do so. Gentlemen, I'm not an expert at the of FERC. We have actually a gentleman to my left here who is very versed in these issues, and I'm very happy to have him on this committee here. He's kind of like the anchor of this thing, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to FERC issues, at least. And so my questions may not be articulated real well, so bear with me, but say if there were, what kind of reach does the U.S. federal government have in terms of your agency when it comes to dealing with the Canadian companies? Say if there was a certificate transfer between a couple of Canadian companies, is there going to be any complication there potentially? I know that's hypothetical again, but wanted to just toss that one out as a hopefully halfway decent question for you.
Well, is this a Canadian company that holds a FERC certificate? If so, then it is subjecting itself to the commission's jurisdiction to the extent it's a certificate holder and would have to comply with whatever orders the commission might issue. If it's a Canadian company dealing with Canadian assets, then obviously we have no jurisdiction over it.
That makes sense. Thank you for that. Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you. On that point, we've had discussion in this room in the past about the question about how seamless a pipeline would be between FERC authority and Canadian authority, between the different regulatory bodies. And I'm not sure about anybody else, but I really didn't get an answer. But from your experience, how does that transition work if there's different requirements for either capacity or expansion?
Well, this would be a relatively unique situation, but we have worked with the NEB before on projects, as they say, and we have an MOU with the NEB that was entered into, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago regarding cross-border projects, particularly with an Alaska project in mind, in which it was agreed that there would be a complete exchange of information to the extent permitted by law if projects were proposed, that the NEB and FERC staffs would be dealing with each other. And I think it would be in everyone's interest to work real hard on that, because you don't want, you know, the pipelines to not match up at the Canadian border, whether it's geographically or in terms of pipeline size or compression or what have you. So we don't have authority, obviously, to require the NEB to do something, but I find it hard to imagine that the two agencies would not work very, very closely together on that type of issue.
And we do meet on a trilateral basis 3 times a year with the NEB and the Mexican CRE. One meeting in each country to keep each other informed on matters in general, and you know, to make sure that we're, you know, coordinating to a degree. I'd also point out, of course, that there are a number of pipelines already crossing the border. You know, the Alliance, I guess, is maybe the biggest and most recent. But you've got Iroquois, you've got Maritimes, Millennium, which isn't built yet, but you know, has now been authorized twice, and the authorizations include a condition that recognize, of course, that there's a Canadian component. So there's a lot of coordination, and you know, obviously, you know, we don't agree 100% on every single thing, but these major projects require coordination, and that's always been the history.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your question reminded me of a question that may be applied if a Canadian route is picked here for the pipeline, and that's this, gentlemen. Part of the pipeline will be built in Alaska. Part of it would be built through Canada. It's not clear to us whether there would be any more of the pipeline built in the continental United States, or whether at this point whether it would stop somewhere in Canada and the gas would be sold there. But I take it that FERC's authority to regulate the pipeline then comes on the Alaska portion, because it's connected to an international pipeline. Is that the right way to understand this?
Because the gas is moving in interstate or foreign commerce. Yes.
And if, as has been suggested, there would also be on the Alaskan section of the pipeline authority for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to be involved in these matters, do you have any kind of protocol with the RCA on something like this?
We also have an MOU with the RCA, which doesn't solve all issues either. But there is that, you know, that relationship. I would say though that what, at least the way I've been reading the 04 Act, FERC would have jurisdiction over the let's say the trunk line, the interstate line that's, you know, that's headed south, and the RCA might have jurisdiction over the lines that are delivery lines off that line, you know, after, let's say, downstream of the meter, just as you know, throughout the lower 48, we have interstate pipelines delivering into local distribution companies. The local distribution companies are all regulated by the respective states.
Follow up, Representative Dugan, then we'll go to Representative Samuels.
Thank you for that answer. And if the pipeline were to be built entirely within the state of Alaska, with the gas going to a port in Alaska and going through the process to become LNG for export, would FERC have regulatory authority over that?
The premise, I think, is that the gas will continue from what you described down to the lower 48. So it doesn't. It wouldn't just end, you know, let's say at the terminal.
Right. So,
which is a somewhat different scenario than the Yukon Pacific situation 15 years ago, where that LNG was sort of earmarked for export.
Right. I think you may have seen in a letter to Representative Samuels, there was a reference to Commission staff's kind of informal opinion as to the effect that Rob just repeated, and you know, that's not an opinion of the Commission, and it's not based on an actual situation, but our sense is, as Rob said.
So if the gas were going to be liquefied and then regasified and sold in the United States, FERC would have jurisdiction. If it were strictly for export, you wouldn't? Am I?
Well,
is that
well? In the first scenario, it's going to the lower 48. Therefore, it's in interstate commerce.
Right.
Okay. It's FERC jurisdictional.
Mm-hmm.
For that reason, because of interstate commerce, FERC also has jurisdiction over facilities involved in exports. If it were an export facility like it was, you know, back in the 80s or the early 90s for Yukon Pacific, there was a determination at the time that the line from the North Slope down to the terminal was not FERC jurisdictional. But the terminal, of course, was jurisdictional.
So the only way to get away from you guys is to somehow beam it off a satellite somewhere, I guess?
Well,
or consume it all within the state.
Ah.
Or export it all, but then I don't know. Then there's an issue with the 04 Act and loan guarantees and all that other.
Mm-hmm.
So there are implications to that. The other factoid on the Yukon Pacific that might be different now was that I think it was Interior or one of the other agencies that did an EIS on that line because of the right of way. And if there's not something similar involved now, then of course, you know, FERC would be doing the EIS. Mm-hmm. So I guess the way we see it is that one way or another, it's FERC jurisdictional, but most likely because it's in interstate commerce.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I wanted to recognize Representative Ramirez, sir, for joining us. That gives us a full slate of committee members. Appreciate that. And Commissioner Pat Galvin in the audience, who's playing a very key role in this piece of legislation on behalf of the administration. I wanted to recognize him, too. And also for those that have arrived since the start of the meeting, I wanted to, obviously it's the FERC folks that we have with us, but we've got John Katz, who's the Deputy Associate General Counsel on Energy Projects with the Office of General Counsel, and Robert Cupina, who's the Deputy Director of the Office of Energy Projects, just to identify these gentlemen that are representing FERC and answering your questions. So we'll go to Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a question again for Mr. Cupina. In the legislation, we've got several rate-making questions. There's a prohibition on negotiated rates. There is the rolled-in tariffs, which can go to more than 15% of the original recourse rates. So if Congress or FERC said in their 2005 order that you have a presumption of rolled-in tariffs, and the pipeline entity, the midstream entity, has to approach you with this rate-making methodology in order to get the license. And the shippers, do they still approach you? How does the process work if Exxon, Conoco, and BP, if there was going to be a rate-making case, do they all approach you and say, no, we think this particular one should be incremental, but you have a presumption of rolled in, and then the pipeline company says that you've got the 15%, and they're, when that fight takes place, everybody gets their stab at it, and then the commission simply decides? What's your process when there's a dispute?
Well, the process starts out in this certificate stage where what we call initial rates are set. So based on, let's say, estimated costs and projected costs, and your debt equity ratio and the rates of, you know, rates of return and so on, an initial rate is set in the certificate, and that's the rate that goes into the tariff as when the pipeline opens for business, and what's in the contracts that are signed, you know, for the shippers that start their service when the pipeline starts service. Somewhere down the road, if the pipeline wants to increase its rates or it does an expansion, it would come into FERC under what's called a Section 4 rate change filing. So it's no longer a certificate matter under Section 7, the way we've been talking about the construction, but now it's a rate change. And that's a different kind of a process where there's often a hearing before a law judge. There's testimony taken. There's back and forth on all these various allocations and rate design and so on. So here we've got kind of a number of guidelines, I guess, that were set out in the 04 Act, that are set out in the 2005 order that the Commission issued, that would be set out in your legislation when that passes. Taking all these things into account, I think I repeat something John Katz said earlier, that is, if these are what the parties feel are necessary, you know, to make a project in Alaska work, the Commission would certainly, I feel, you know, seriously consider those things.
Yes.
But it would be a separate process down the road after the certificate.
All right. The only thing I would add to what Rob said is that there's an additional section of the Natural Gas Act, Section 5, where if any of the parties on an ongoing basis or the Commission itself decides that the rates being charged are not proper, they can seek to have those reviewed. That's relatively unusual.
Follow up, but it's not a problem to contractually obligate the midstream entity to seek a course of action before the certificate is even issued. I mean, we're going to dictate that the midstream entity follow a course of action today for an expansion which is going to take 15 years from now, and they will have to support that role. That's not a problem with FERC to do that.
Well, I guess it's not. FERC, I don't think, typically has a problem with people entering into contracts, but those contracts couldn't obviously bind the FERC to do what the contracts called for if the Commission at the end of the day felt that the evidence supported some other result. Also, the Commission would not probably favor results that barred a party from coming before the Commission or from seeking a particular result. So in other words, if some shipper agreed to, you know, a particular debt equity ratio or something, that the pipeline was going to have a particular debt equity ratio, and it came before the Commission and argued some other result, the Commission probably would not throw them out based on the fact that they had agreed to this with the state or with whoever else. The Commission would hear that on its merits and would probably say something like, and, you know, if the entity has violated its contract with the state, then the state can take them to court and, you know, get whatever relief would be appropriate. But that because the Commission is a federal agency, the Commission can't preclude people from coming in the door and for making arguments before. You know, we have to be open to all arguments by all people who want to come before us. And if they've contractually gotten themselves in a position where they're supposed to be doing something else, that's more a matter of private contract than it is a matter for the Commission to consider.
Yeah. The state has defended in a position that disagrees with. Follow-up question.
Mm-hmm.
You just said, Mr. Capino, you just said that the rate is in the certificate. So procedurally then, the certificate's issued before construction, and cost overruns come into play. So procedurally, how do you end up with your true base rate on the first day gas is shipped?
There've also been situations where the certificate holder would come in before commencing service on the basis of, you know, whatever increased costs there were, and ask to amend the certificate to change the initial rate. Okay, so it's not a rate change under Section 4 the way we've been talking because no service has started. It's an amendment to the certificate to change the initial rates before any service is rendered under those rates. So of course that would be another opportunity, you know, for assuming that the shippers don't agree with that, be another opportunity for them to protest it. So that's one way. The other way that the commission, I think, has addressed this in this 1999 certificate policy statement is to kind of tell the parties, the pipeline and the shippers, that they're encouraged to work out these cost overrun sharing of the risks, as it were, right up front, so that they, you know, there wouldn't be a situation where it's a surprise to someone and we're talking about a rate increase that no one bargained for. So that's another approach to it. Have some sort of a risk sharing provision in the event of cost overruns or whatever the situation is that's of concern.
So, if I could, Mr. Chairman, if the FERC would have, I just want to kind of wrap it all up in the last question here. Mm-hmm. The FERC would probably have no opinion that if in the legislation we would say that all cost overruns must be debt financed, then the midstream entity in their bid to amend the certificate with their base rate would simply go forward with the cost overruns with the debt finance amount and say we need to adjust by so many cents, and the FERC would go with that. Nobody would argue with that. The shippers, I wouldn't think, would argue with that. But even if they did, that would simply be your method on that. And how long does that take then? All of your various processes, and you said there's a hearing that goes on. How long would it take to set the base rate once the gas is shipped, just on a typical pipeline?
Well, again, the initial rate, of course, as we said, is set along in the certificate proceeding, you know, before the pipeline opens for business. If this change happens before, sometime after the certificate is issued, but before the pipeline starts service and they file to amend the certificate, that could be a relatively short turnaround. If it's after the pipeline starts service and they do a rate change filing under Section 4, that's with the hearings and so on, that's a year process. I mean, some kind of a rate will go into effect subject to refund, but the final word on it will take quite a while.
Yeah, a Section 4 rate case can take more or less time depending on how hotly contested it is, what sort of testimony people want to put forward, and so forth. But we can't really predict it.
Wouldn't it be as long as TAPS, but it would take a while.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions? Gentlemen, I have something here that my staff had reminded me of a question I was going to ask, and that has to do with the issue of abandonment. That's something that's come up in previous discussions here in our hearings over the last couple of weeks. Say if we were to, the state were to award a contract, and then the, I guess there's a provision in the bill for the contractor to abandon the project if it's deemed, if I understand right, not financially feasible, et cetera. And I was wondering, what are your thoughts on that, and how would FERC respond to that kind of scenario?
Are you talking about post-certificate issuance or pre-certificate issuance?
How about both?
Yeah, the commission, pre-certificate, obviously the commission can't require anyone to pursue a project they don't want to pursue. So if someone said, gee, we were looking into this and we've decided we're not going to move forward with it, the commission would have to accept that. Post-certificate, the commission has never, I don't think, and Rob, please correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think the commission's ever made any efforts to force someone to construct something if they decide it was uneconomical or for whatever reason they didn't want to construct. They have a time frame, as Rob said, and we're supposed to conclude construction. And if they decide that they're not going to do that, you know, that's what they do. Typically, this would be a little different, at least from your perspective, because typically when that happens, the only money that is at risk is that of the sponsoring entity. So if a pipeline puts some millions of dollars into developing a project, but they don't go forward, you know, no one is hurt except that entity, you know, possibly its shareholders, but no one else. Your situation would be different, and I presume that would be something you folks would be considering as you look at this legislation.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. That helps. I wanted to, Representative Samuels, I'll get to mine later.
I lied. I have another couple questions. Does the $500 million grant automatically lower the tariff? The testimony was it would lower the tariff, you know, four to six cents, something like that. Does the $500 million, but just by simply lowering the cost, does it automatically pass through to the tariff, or is there something else that needs to be done?
Well, that's hard to say, because if they're negotiated rates, then, I mean, it might effectively do that, but there'd be no way to trace the arithmetic. But, Rob, I don't know if you have anything.
I'm just thinking that in as much as initial rates are cost-based, and let's so we assume that they're reflecting, you know, the costs that are brought to the commission and seem reasonable. So since those initial rates are cost based, if the costs are lower for whatever reason, then I would think the initial rates would be lower, all other things being equal.
Okay, thanks.
And you, I think you said something, or one of you said something earlier about no negotiated rates. So
that's correct.
So we would just be talking about the cost-based rate.
Ah, okay.
I wanted to recognize the entry of Commissioner of Natural Resources, Tom Irwin, who, along with Commissioner of Revenue, Pat Galvin, are going to play a very, very key role in this whole process here, because those are the gentlemen that are going to be evaluating the applications that we hope to receive, and making sure that the criteria fit their application credentials and choose who is going to build the gas line. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Welcome. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Prior to an open season, it looks like you allow for pre-subscription agreements, possibly more than one, and I don't know how many. How does that affect agreements, the open season itself? It seems like it's open for a lot of gamemanship.
That came up in the order 2005.
Yeah.
And it was, I think, one of the balancing elements that the commission perceived was part of the public interest, because, ideally, I suppose, an open season is totally open and no one has any capacity going in. But I think a case was made to the commission, and the commission agreed with it, that to launch a project, it especially something, you know, of this size, you might have anchor shippers, and then the only real risk, I guess, on other shippers is that they not be discriminated against for the capacity that they want. In other words, that it be offered on the same terms, and so that's what the commission did in order 2005. They said, all right, you can have some pre-subscriptions, but anyone who comes in the open season will be allowed to match whatever one of those, and then you have to be transparent about the terms of those pre-subscription agreements. But anyone who comes in later gets to choose from whichever of those deals is best for them.
Right. I absolutely agree with what Rob said. That was something the commission gave a lot of thought to, and making sure that people who were not in on the original deal were not cut out or disadvantaged was important to the commission, and so it did make the requirements that Rob has referenced.
Follow-up, Representative Guttenberg?
Does this kind of arrangement exist anywhere else?
In terms of pre-subscriptions?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. It's not that unusual.
Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things the committee is wrestling with is the criteria that are going to be used to decide who gets the license that's going to be awarded in this bill. And since you folks are in the business of licensing pipelines, I was wondering if there is available to me anywhere a published list of FERC's criteria for evaluating pipeline proposals.
I guess the one thing I would recommend to you is this policy statement that I've been talking about from 1999, and I can get the specific site and even send an electronic copy to whomever, because that kind of looks back at what the commission was doing up until that point, and then looked ahead to recognize that the industry was changing and the whole unbundling and Order 636 kind of aftermath, and set forth the various components of the public interest that the commission would look at, and in some cases make trade-offs or again balances for benefits and costs. But every certificate has every project is case specific, and they're all a little bit different, and they have their own little idiosyncrasies.
Yeah, and I would add that the commission's policy, basically for about I guess the last 20 years or so, has been to let the market decide whether particular pipelines get built, provided that the pipeline sponsors are the ones who are taking an appropriate share of the risk. And I think there was a recognition in Order 2005 that an Alaska pipeline has an importance and has costs and benefits that are substantially higher than a typical pipeline project. And so some of the normal ways our commission does business might differ in the case of an Alaska pipeline in recognition of the magnitude of the project and its importance. So there may not be an exact link up between what the commission's done in the past and what would happen with an Alaska project.
Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. I'm not really looking to FERC's criteria to get me to dry land. I'm just trying to keep from drowning here. So perhaps if one of you could see to it that a copy of the policy statement was sent to the chairman's aide, who could then distribute it to the members of the committee, I, for one, would certainly appreciate it.
Just give me the contact before we're finished. Or
just for your brief and quick reference, our ERIC code is 907-465-3818. That is my fax number. I'm coring the chairman, and forgive me for failing to identify myself as the chair. In case you're wondering who speaks periodically, the soft
we knew that
guy would be a bit coring. I wanted to thank Representative Dugan. That was an excellent question here. I know the criteria that you guys would send us are just general in nature and may not necessarily be completely germane to Alaska here, but just to give us some things to contemplate, to think about, some general guidelines that we might want to consider incorporating into our bill. And I wanted to, since I'm on that subject, note that we are not going to go with a formal subcommittee process. I had announced a committee the other day. We're going to have a committee of the whole, where members of the previous subcommittee are going to provide us with their ideas and recommendations, and then we'll discuss it as a committee as a whole. It was asked of me to do it that way because there were many members of this body that wanted to be a part of that subcommittee, and I thought, well, we'll just make it a committee of the whole oil and gas committee and just do it that way. So we hope to have those ideas and recommendations here in the next few days or so. And perhaps most, if not all, those will be incorporated into a committee substitute that we'll bring back to the committee by the end of next week, which is my goal, by the way, for the benefit of the committee and the audience, because I know there's some real anxiousness out there as far as expediting this thing in light of the fact that we're two-thirds of the way through the session. So the goal is to have a CS and then take up any additional amendments by the end of next week. Representatives Samuels and then Dahlstrom.
I'll defer. Go ahead.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I just want to commend you for making that decision. I think it's the right thing to do with as many members of the committee wanting to be at every single meeting and the importance of the issue that we are discussing. And I also think that with the public noticing requirements that we have for subcommittees, I think we can more effectively and at a much quicker rate accomplish what we need to do here as a committee of the whole. So I think you made the right decision. I want to thank you for that.
You're welcome. Thank you for your observations. Representative Samuel?
Thank you. I have a question, I guess, probably for Mr. Capena again. If we had a licensee today, how fast could you have an open season done working with our licensee?
Well, I was looking at Order 2005 again the other day, and it looks like 180 days is what was contemplated. In other words, the licensee would have to come to FERC and propose its plan, its open season plan. And I can't remember, I think it was a 60-day turnaround. And then FERC would, you know, most likely approve it with some modifications. That's a typical response. Then that plan then would be carried out. So I think that has to run for 60 days as the actual open season. And then I can't remember, but what I do remember is that in the original 2005, that whole period turned out to be 210 days, and on the rehearing order, the commission cut 30 days from it and said, okay, it'll take about 180 days.
Right.
Okay. So that's where I get that number, but I think this is a good time to maybe stress the point that even though it might seem as if an open season, you know, is the very first thing to do, and maybe for whoever's the, you know, the licensee, that makes the most sense. It's not, we don't necessarily require that to happen first, okay? There has to be an open season before a certificate application. But this pre-filing period and this application development can be underway while an open season is running. Okay, so we don't want to stop the clock and wait for an open season if the parties want to get out in the field right away. So I guess it's a long way of saying you can do an open season during the pre-filing process while the field work and everything else is going on, and they could all happen simultaneously, as long as that open season is completed before the eventual certificate application is filed, which, from what we've heard over the past few years, you know, would be two field seasons later. So, you know, just imagining that something were to happen on the license front by under AGEA next spring, and that licensee could get out in the field. They'd be out in the field next year and the year after, and then we'd expect the application. During those two field seasons, the open season could be running.
And it's also the case that the commission can waive its regulations so that if there was a sense that the project needed to be moving more quickly and the party that was conducting the open season, for example, got together with potential bidders and reached agreement with them as to the conduct of the open season, so that when they made their open season proposal filing with the commission, they were able to say, and we've had public discussion of this, and everybody agrees to it, and therefore, FERC, we'd like you to act on this more quickly. That might be possible, but a lot of it would depend on whether the parties were able to develop some consensus as to appropriate procedures.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
So don't think series, think parallel processes. Because we're all for, you know, streamlining as much as we can when the time is right.
I appreciate that.
Okay.
We're in a streamlining mode here in Alaska State Government. We always have been. very efficient group here. So we like those words. Thank you. Help me out, guys. Well, I can offer a generic question here. I, as chairman, am facilitating getting this bill through in a good way, and we hope to have a good product that's a workable product, too, and one that reflects federal law, federal regulations. And so having said that, I just want to make sure that you gentlemen make it abundantly clear before we actually pass a bill and send it off to the governor for her signature that it does meet the FERC requirements. I know in your opening remarks you did mention that you thought the bill did in fact meet that, but I want to confirm that with you and ask that you folks watch closely the progress of this bill as it's amended, and if there's any issues that come along, any red flags that cause you any concern, please let us know. That would perhaps warrant changes to that bill, or perhaps that might even warrant some changes at the federal level in terms of any regulations to make the whole process work. So
we will do that, and I can confirm that we looked at the bill and thought it was very well crafted in the sense of where it dovetailed into the FERC process. It required, you know, the successful Alaska bidder to do certain things, like make their hold their open season within a specified time frame, conduct their pre-filing process in a specified time frame, but it did not purport to change the commission's time frames at all, and therefore we didn't see any conflict at all between it and our regulations.
Okay, thank you. That's a real assuring, and I want to acknowledge and commend the folks in the administration who crafted this bill, too, for putting together a good piece of legislation. However, it is subject to change and likely will have some modifications, so I will make a point at keeping you folks apprised, and we'll email you copies of the bill as it changes when it moves along through the process for your further review.
Well, we'll be glad to provide any help we can. I mean, I think it's no secret in Alaska that at least the last four or five chairmen that I've worked with have all been strongly supportive of an Alaska project and recognize the importance of the resource development both to you folks in Alaska and to those in the lower 48. And I think that, you know, as staff members, our mandate is to do what we can to be helpful.
Excellent. Thank you so very much. Representative Dugan.
Mr. Chairman, if the other members of the committee don't have any questions, I just wanted to thank these gentlemen for taking an hour of what I assume would otherwise be their personal time to help us out on this issue, and to say that if I can be of any assistance to you in getting that hour of personal time back, please don't hesitate to call on me.
Well, you're very welcome. Yes.
Why don't you give
I'll get home in time to read my bedtime story, so I'm okay.
You read his book. Yeah.
Send him a
I'd like to echo that as well. Thank you, Representative Dugan, for acknowledging their efforts.
Thanks for not insisting that we take a trip to Juneau. Not that we mind being up there, but this is much more convenient for us.
Well, you just lost one friend on this committee, but...
You're welcome to come anytime. It's a lovely place. Yes.
I've been there. It's been wonderful.
We just reached a history-making point yesterday. Folks in D.C. there, we reached a snowfall total of, I think, 124 inches or whatever the number was that broke it all. 194
Everybody
inches.
Knows.
That broke the all-time record in the history of the city of Juneau. That's equivalent to about 16 feet of snow, I understand.
I think that beats Oswego, New York.
Yes. Well, thank you so very much for taking your time in the day, your personal time. I know it's 10 after 8 there in D.C. or on the East Coast, wherever you're located at the moment. But we really do appreciate it. You provided us some great insight, answered our questions very well, and we look forward to continue working with you.
Anytime.
Thank you, gentlemen. We do, too.
Okay.
And good evening.
Good night.
Bye.
Good night. Thanks again. For the benefit of the committee, we will meet again tomorrow. And tomorrow is to... begin the process of hearing from the oil companies. I want to say producers, but there's more involved than just the producers, and tomorrow it'll be ExxonMobil that'll be presenting to us. And then we're really going to hit that in earnest next week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And then following that, we will be ready to wrap things up here so we can move this bill along. Tomorrow's time, I believe, is 8:30 in the morning, Jim, is that correct? And where is the committee hearing? Is the Hess? 106, which is the Hess room just next door to us over here. So with all of that, I'd like to thank everybody for participation and close this meeting at 4:07 p.m.